This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM.
And when we wrote the book, our argument was, in a nutshell, that we're hitting a new stage of the digital revolution that's going to make what we've seen in the last 30 years really look like small potatoes, really child's play with what's about to hit us in the next 5 or 10 or 15 years. And it's going to create an enormous political crisis that's going to fundamentally change the political calculus everywhere in the world. And we anticipated that this was going to really hit hard, and we wouldn't notice much about it till, you know, a few years from now that it would really start hitting. Because this is really a horrible time to be a young person economically. Economically, the way the world's working today, we're seeing a stagnant, failing capitalism worldwide with growing inequality, increasing poverty. Working conditions suck. I mean, the pensions, forget about it if you're young. The sort of stability that people assumed would come with labor when I was 25 years old, unthinkable today. It's not a very good looking picture at all. What we argue is that the digital revolution we're all familiar with, that we have cell phones and World Wide Web and all that stuff, that's a profound revolution. That's a revolution that certainly I think scholars would say is the equivalent of the printing press or the alphabet or writing, maybe even language itself. It's that fundamental in redefining the nature of life as we're experiencing it on Earth. So it's one of the big ones. It changes everything. It's much bigger than television. I mean, it's a whole quantum leap above something like television. But we think we're on the verge now, and we're in the midst now, is a better way to put it, of the next stage, which is the growth of artificial intelligence and the ability basically to eliminate much of human labor. And not 50 or 80 years from now, but real soon. I mean, a lot of these jobs could go now. And that's going to dramatically change everything politically. So we have a terrible labor market to begin with, and then we're about to introduce some technologies that can wipe out the jobs, a lot of the jobs that actually remain still. You know, that's going to raise the temperature in the room quite a bit, and that's the moment we're entering. How many jobs we lose, no one knows. But the Oxford study from a couple of years ago suggested 50%. Eric Schmidt at Google gave a speech at Davos 2 years ago, in which he basically made it sound like that's not an unrealistic number for the next two decades of existing jobs without anyone seeing anything coming along to replace them. DARPA, which is in the United States, is connected to the Pentagon. It's called the Defense Advanced Research Program. It's the people who did much of the research that created the internet over the last 50 years. And still really guides a lot of the cutting edge research in digital technology that influences where things are going. DARPA has, for the last 10 years, had a special project in robotics with huge prizes for innovation. And the guy who ran the robotics project at DARPA left last summer and wrote an article for a journal on what they're working on and what it's going to mean. And he said the only way to really understand what's happening with the digital revolution, the next stage, is to understand that it's, you know, it's nothing like, you know, the alphabet or speech. Or the printing press, it's really the way it's, what's coming down the line, the comparison would be to the Cambrian explosion. The Cambrian explosion refers to that period 540 million years ago in which life went from single cell and simplistic organisms to complex organisms. And it's a relatively brief 20 million year period, but things like walking, vision, all sorts of things that didn't exist suddenly blossomed. There's literally an explosion in life, and it got us to where we are today. He said, that's what we're going into. We're going into a Cambrian explosion. So everything until now has been single-cell amoebas. And we're about to go into a Cambrian explosion. That's what he said we're looking at. That's the sort of stuff they're working on. And among other things he said, to follow up the story, he said, one of the things that artificial intelligence will be able to do very soon, that is already beginning to do, is have complete vision faculties. Now, this has been implicit in the digital revolution from the very beginning, this sort of automation. In fact, when the first computers came along, in the 1940s, there were already lots of articles about this is going to end labor almost immediately. I mean, Fortune magazine ran an article on the end of labor in 1946, 2 years after computers first began. They were already understood that the ability, what computers could do, could really eliminate much of the need for human labor. By the 1960s, this became a big issue. There was lots of press coverage of it, books written. There was all sorts of hysteria that all the jobs in the world were going to be gone by the end of the 1960s. And now we read this stuff, and I read it for the book. We write about it at some length in chapter two in the book. And it's laughable that they were so concerned, because back then the technology was so primitive. It couldn't, and it didn't really happen. But computers have grown in tremendous power since then. You're all, I suspect, familiar with the term Moore's Law, the idea that computer power doubles every year and a half, roughly. And it's proven astonishingly accurate. Well, if you take two to increase the power of what two goes to by doubling it every year and a half, what you find is after about 40 or 50 years, when you're doubling it, you're giving some unbelievably mind-boggling increases in power. And that's what's happening right now with computers. And it's been happening. We're entering sort of uncharted territory in which computers now are able to do stuff that was unthinkable just a few years ago. Just the new iPhones that were sold in the fall of 2014, the first weekend, just the power of just the iPhone sold that weekend had 25 times more power than all the computers in the world in 1995. Just those iPhones sold that weekend, 25 times more power than all the computers in the world in 1995. And imagine that increasing at an exponential rate 10, 20 years out from 2014. That's what we're in now. And that's why we're talking about a Cambrian explosion, the sort of things that can be done. Now, the guy at DARPA said, we don't know how this is going to change the human race. He said, the only thing we know for certain, it's going to eliminate most jobs. When exactly, we don't know, but a lot of them fairly soon. This raises some real problems for capitalism. And it raises real problems for society, for the economy, fundamental existential questions. Really, we're in a situation now where we need very few people to produce what we need to sustain life. We don't need all of us to work all the time. Now, it used to be that was good news. That's great, man. Don't have to work so hard. I can do poetry. I can, you know, jog, do whatever I want. And everyone can live a comfortable life. That was the theory. Under capitalism, it doesn't quite work that way, though. It's sort of the opposite effect. This ability to be able to have fewer and fewer people produce more and more, that much less labor is needed, turns into instead a situation where the economy doesn't really work. There's no one who can buy products, so there's no incentive to invest. So instead of having a bounty and a whole different type of economy, you have a stagnant, the stagnation gets worse, the poverty grows, the insecurity grows. And that's the moment we're entering. And this is why this is such a troubling moment to have this revolution in a troubling context for it to take place in. We argue in the book that clearly what we need is a post-capitalist economy. We need to have an economy where these technologies make our lives better, work for us, not imprison us into poverty and joblessness. And that's the great political question of our time. How do we get there? What do we do to get a post-capitalist economy? And our argument is that the solution is real clear. It's democracy. The solution is we need to extend and strengthen democratic practices and institutions so that people can participate in reconstructing the society and the economy. And if we don't have a democratic solution to it, decisions will be made by elites to serve their interests. And we've seen enough of how the world works around us. That will not be a solution that necessarily is going to be very good for most people in the world. As the great saying goes in the United States, if you're not at the table when a decision's being made, you're what's being served. And so democracy means everyone gets a seat at the table. How do you do that? What does that mean? How do you democratize a society? We argue that the crucial thing for society is to build up what we call the democratic infrastructure. The democratic infrastructure is, if you understand an economic infrastructure, you can't just start an economy, start a business or an enterprise or a co-op willy-nilly. You need to have transportation infrastructure, communication, electric, water infrastructure. You need all sorts of things, a legal infrastructure, to make it possible to do an economic activity. Well, the same thing's true for democracy. Just having the right to vote is insufficient. You really need a lot of other things to give individuals the power so they can be effective participants in governance. Some of this is pretty obvious: fair elections, the ability to vote, you know, having credible journalism. You need checks on inequality, things like progressive taxation. You need to have checks on militarism. These are the things that are the cancers that destroy the democratic infrastructure and make it harder for societies to be self-governing. Healthcare is a right, free quality education, so everyone is educated. That's a core part of a democratic infrastructure. Checks on corruption. This is what you have to build out to have the basis, the foundation, so that you can have a self-governing society. Now, in the United States, conservatives in particular, but not just conservatives, oftentimes say, well, we've never had that in America. That's not the American way. I don't know what that is, but it's not American democracy. You know, American democracy is everyone's in it for themselves. The government's job is just to get out of the way and fight wars, and it's left to people to get as rich as possible, and whoever dies with the most money wins. And in fact, that's a very misleading view of American history. It's a very misleading view of any country's history. In fact, in our book, we go through the battle to build a democratic infrastructure in U.S. history, and what we discover is from the very beginning of the country, it was a central fight, building out these institutions to empower people so they could actually participate. It's had ebbs and flows, but really right back to the Constitution, you see it. From about 1900 to 1970, the United States became a vastly more democratic country, a much more egalitarian country, much more social mobility, a better country. For one thing, in 1900, a very small percentage of the population still was actively voting in elections. Women couldn't vote, African Americans couldn't vote in the South. By 1970, finally, the entire adult population was allowed to vote in America. We became a modern liberal democracy. But it was much more than that. We built out things like the right to labor unions, Social Security, old age pensions, like that, public education. We basically had virtually free public higher education in America by the 1960s, now considered a radical idea when someone proposes it, but was taken for granted in California and New York State 50 years ago. We built out the democratic infrastructure. We had less inequality in America by 1970 than ever in the country's history, certainly far less than we have today. So this is a period we look at. This is a period that sort of shows us an interesting path we can learn from as we try to deal with the crisis we face today. And in the book, we look specifically at two periods that we think are of particular importance to understand the crisis we're about to go into. The first one is the 1930s, the Depression. And the reason why this is so important, this is a period in Canada and the United States and Europe in which there was massive unemployment. And how do countries deal with massive unemployment in the 1930s? Well, this is where the historical record's very important. One way was the U.S., the New Deal, sort of social democracy, what took place in Western Europe, which was basically to build out the democratic infrastructure and build out democracy and have the state play a large role enhancing the role of workers in the society, to varying degrees depending upon the country. The other option, though, was fascism. The other option in the most advanced and powerful country in Europe, Germany at the time, with mass unemployment, was to turn to fascism, which was sort of the revolutionary idea that people would organize to get rid of democracy, and that it would be a state that would work closely with the dominant economic interests to run the country and prevent the masses from really getting in their way. And why the 30s and 40s is so important is because that was when fascism emerged. That's precisely when the United States and other countries of the world said, what can we do as we battle against the Nazis, as we battle against fascism, to make sure this never comes back again? How can we prevent this scourge of fascism from ever returning? FDR, Franklin Roosevelt, the American president at the time, put a lot of energy into this issue, studied it, wrote about it, and he argued, and I think accurately, that fascism emerged in countries where the democracy was weak, it was corrupt, and had lost credibility. And the foundation of returning, making it so fascism would never return to the society, was to build out and strengthen the democracy. And specifically, in his State of the Union address in 1944, he said the United States Constitution should add a series of new amendments, new rights to people, that if we put these in, we'll pretty much guarantee we'll never have to worry about fascism in this country. The right to an education, the right to a job at a living wage, the right to health care, the right to not have business monopolies that dominate the economy and the government. These are things that should be in our Constitution. This is what we have to do to guarantee we never have fascism again. It was very prescient. In fact, the vision he put forward there, and I'm just giving you a taste of it, was later adopted by Martin Luther King in the 1960s, almost verbatim, to be his freedom budget. And it also became the core of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which Eleanor Roosevelt took from Franklin's 1944 address. So that was a response to how you deal with fascism and prevent it returning. I think there's a lot to learn there. The second period we study at length, and I'll end on this, was in the 1960s and early 70s. That's when that automation boom took place that I talked about. But it's also a very important period because this was the first time society really dealt with the idea of living in a post-scarcity world. What would it be like to live in a world in which for the first time humanity did not have to be obsessed with its material survival, that it could actually do something different? And our greatest economists, John Stuart Mill, John Maynard Keynes, Marx, had all considered this in varying ways. This was a central, Thurston Veblen. How do we deal with this moment that's coming? And in the 1960s, it became not a hypothetical thing. You know, we're at a point now that we're in a situation where a lot of people won't have to work that much and we can have a very satisfactory standard of living. And it started a whole new discussion. And what we saw was capitalism, American capitalism, was hitting its peak. It was probably the strongest period of the 20th century, if not its entire history. Yet at the exact same time, it was at its all-time peak in terms of standard of living. I think working class wages probably at their all-time highest by the early 1970s in real terms. At this exact same period, we have a very strong left, stronger than we had seen in a long time. A social movement saying we can still do a lot better. We can make this a much better country. And the whole impetus of the movement was to take up FDR's call from the 40s and to really expand the democratic infrastructure and to go to a post-capitalist society. It was really a striking period that's been largely forgotten. And the reason why it's been largely forgotten is that by the early 1970s, the American business community banded together and they really said, we've got to take the government over here. We've got to change it and go back to the days that, as John Adams put it, those who own the country should govern it. And they instituted enormous lobbying, enormous public relations. They set up a system, the corruption that's in place today, such that in 1970, when a person retired from a job in Congress, they usually would go back home and teach at a college for a couple of years. Today, well over half the people who leave Congress become million-dollar-a-year lobbyists in Washington. That industry didn't even exist in 1970, K Street. But now it's a $9 billion-a-year industry of people who make a fortune lobbying for corporations in Congress. And the corruption has been built in, and the whole movement that government can only really not serve people, but it should be there to serve the business interests has taken over. The counter-revolution is the moment we're in today. And because of this counter-revolution, people oftentimes have been depressed. Much of my academic career, and I think those who are my age have fought it, I've been dealing with people and walking around in varying degrees of depression about how hopeless it seems living in this world when the system is so incapable of dealing with the great crises around us. That period of neoliberal, whoever makes the most money wins, government should work for them, it can't do anything for us, that's not working anymore. That's officially exhausted. Now it hangs on by power of corruption, but it hangs on with no legitimacy otherwise. And it will have much less legitimacy in coming years. That's the great struggle. But we're entering a new movement. We're entering a new time period where we're going to have to deal with what's coming at us. And we face frightening prospects if nothing changes, but something will change. But we also face a moment we're entering quickly, and the more social activism is, the sooner that moment comes, in which seems like impossible problems, suddenly when you have people actively engaged politically, become extraordinary opportunities. And that's our job, to turn impossible problems into extraordinary opportunities.